ask the gathered multitude to gather, multiply, and join with us. Good evening, everyone. My name is David Tycholsker. I am a vice chair of Brooklyn for Peace, the organization that is sponsoring this. As you can see from the sign, we are a mere 30 years young this year. That's a good thing that we're around. It's a bad thing that we still need to be around. Unfortunately, we still do. There is an urgent need for a peace organization that is active and is present in Brooklyn, educating and engaged with people in Brooklyn. We thank Brooklyn Friends for their kindness in hosting this event. Many of you have devices such as the one I'm about to hold up. Let us all join together and put it on silent or stun or off or whatever works for you. Please, 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 please. All right. The program tonight is I'm going to get out of the way relatively quickly. We will present our award to Michael, about whom I will tell you shortly. We will then pause for a moment that refreshes. We will take questions from the audience. I'll be happy to take your questions and have Michael answer them. And then we will adjourn downstairs for a reception till about 9:30. Hope that's acceptable to all, and thank you again for coming. Michael Ratner is the president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, and wisely became the chair of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights in Berlin. He's part of a small group of lawyers that has been representing detainees at Guantanamo since there first was a detainee at Guantanamo beginning in 2002. He has led CCR in establishing a network of lawyers, 600 pro bono lawyers, to represent the Guantanamo detainees, who, notwithstanding the pledge of the president to close the facility, remain incarcerated, and a true shame for the United States and our increasingly appalling human rights record. He is continuing this work with the hope of finally shutting down Guantanamo and ending the policies that underlie it. But of course, the policies that underlie it are what used to be called in the Bush administration the Global War on Terror, or GWAT. Unfortunately, the name has been changed, but the substance of an endless war continues under the Obama administration and is clearly the de facto policy of both major parties in this country. Hence the continuing need for an organization like Brooklyn for Peace to turn that policy around, and hence the continuing need to address the civil liberties infringements that necessarily occur whenever a country goes to war, and that have occurred with disturbing frequency and regularity since the United States embarked on this ill-conceived and largely illegal war on terror. Michael is actively litigating against drone killings, something that we can expect to start seeing in New York City in the not-too-distant future. He represents the family of Anwar al-Awlaki in a damage case against government officials. Mr. al-Awlaki was a citizen of the United States who was killed at the order of the President of the United States without benefit of a criminal indictment, jury, or jury trial. He and CCR, the Center for Constitutional Rights, are currently the U.S. Counsel for WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. I need not describe them to you. He's also engaged in efforts in European courts to bring U.S. officials to account for torture as well as their actions at Guantanamo. Michael has been a leader in litigating in this area of international law since I first encountered him in law school 3 decades ago. continues to do that. So Brooklyn for Peace is honored to present him with this award. Charlotte will do that. Okay. He has to stand up. The official photographer will.
One more. Thank you all.
Thank you. All right, let me say just a few words, more words about Michael before I turn this over to him. Michael has been instrumental in litigating against government spying in its myriad forms. Hello, NSA. Hope you're having a good time as you listen to this and watch us. He has been particularly active in responding to the government's targeting of Muslim activists, something that Brooklyn for Peace began doing immediately following 9/11 and the assaults and roundup of anybody who might have been Muslim or Sikh or South Asian or whatever was the determining factor for why people got rounded up. I would say in conclusion that Michael and CCR have been very active on the issues of Palestinian rights. They've represented the Gaza flotilla, which attempted to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza. He's represented the family of Rachel Corrie. He's worked to protect those who advocate on behalf of Palestinians in this country, something that unfortunately, given the pro-Israeli clampdown that we see continuing at the University of Illinois and other places is absolutely necessary. He is a co-founder of the Palestinian Solidarity Legal Support Organization, which defends the rights of Palestinians across the U.S. Again, this is an area in which Brooklyn for Peace was and continues to be very active. Michael is a worthy recipient. We are honored to have him. I give you Michael Ratner.
Thank you, David. David did work on cases with us, actually, when we were at the center. He worked on, now he reminded me, a case called Filartica v. Pena, which was the first case in the United States where we could hold a torturer who had tortured someone in Paraguay guilty of torture when he came into the United States. It began a long line of cases of holding dictators overseas who would visit the United States for human rights violations. A very, very important line of cases. David was one of the lawyers, Peter Weiss, Rhonda Copeland, and a couple of others. A historic CCR case in 1981. You know, when I decided, when I thought about what I was going to say, I was given some advice. Oh, Michael, make it a somewhat legal talk. You know, you're a lawyer. And I said, well, law isn't doing so well these days. I'll try. We'll get to that. But it's not like we're doing really well on the core issues of drones, wars, Guantanamo. We'll get there. Before that, I went and looked at the Brooklyn Peace website, and I was pleased to see two things immediately which are dear to my heart. One, David mentioned, which is the position on ending the Gaza war and ending the occupation. And when I walked in here, someone said, Michael, you should say something more about that because it's not always the easiest issue for people, just as it wasn't the easiest issue for me, who was raised in a very, very Zionist household. I went to Israel when I was a child. This is unusual, probably no one in the room had this. I had a hand-painted map of Israel on my ceiling, and I was a Zionist. I had a hand-painted map of, is it what working? It's not on, that's the problem. Oh, okay, I'll speak louder then. I had a hand-painted map of Israel on my ceiling, and it took a long evolution in my own life to get to the position where I was both politically as well as emotionally someone who would support Palestinian rights and ending the occupation. I won't give you all that history. That's not what I'm here for. I can only tell you that one of the key events took place very late in my life, One of the key events was when my children, who are now in their mid-20s, said, well, we're interested in going to Gaza. And so I said, well, go to Gaza on a Code Pink trip. And of course, we never got into Gaza. And so we flew to Tel Aviv, took a car into the West Bank. And I took my kids and all of us to Hebron. And once they went through Hebron, they had no issue any longer about how they were going to talk about Palestine and Israel and rights and checkpoints, et cetera. I can only say that emotionally it was a longer distance for me than politically. Politically, I understood it pretty quickly, coming out of the tradition and background I have since the 1960s. Emotionally, it took longer. So that was one thing that on your website, the Brooklyn Peace website, that I liked. The second thing I saw that a position that, again, has not been the easiest, as everybody says, well, what are we going to do with ISIS? We have to bomb, we have to bomb, we have to bomb. And Brooklyn Peace takes a position that it has to be settled through diplomacy and not bombing. Again, a position that I take. And I, again, don't do it out of just naivety. I do it out of some knowledge, and I don't know if many of you have either watched the interviews with Patrick Coburn on Democracy Now! Or read his book, The Rise of the Jihadists, which talks about what happened that brought ISIS to the fore. Of course, we all know, number one, the Iraq War was what devastated that area. We can talk a little bit more about that or get questions. But what Patrick also says is after 9/11, the U.S. went after the wrong people. It should have gone after Saudi Arabia, which was funding all of this, and Pakistan and its security services as well. Gave them a pass, and now, for a combination of factors, we're where we are. Patrick Coburn strongly suggests there has to be some kind of, not a peace treaty, but a truce between Assad, who, of course, the U.S. Had at the overthrow for a long time, but Assad and whatever moderate forces we can find in Syria as the only way in which we're actually going to get out of there without a 10 or 20 year war. So again, as I look at your website, I was pleased to see those two positions. Another thing that I noticed was that the organization was founded in 1984, right after the invasion of Grenada by the United States. Now, I don't know how many of you have been to Grenada, how many of you knew the revolution. I knew that revolution. I was friendly, would be too strong of word, but certainly acquainted with Maurice Bishop. And I brought a case right during that invasion. It was called Conyers v. Reagan, and it was against the illegality of that invasion because it did not have congressional consent. And Congressman Conyers was one of my plaintiffs. He's saying, you bypassed the Congress, you didn't give us the authority to vote on this war. And like the other cases which I'll mention, we lost that case. We lost it at least on the grounds that the war only took 4 days and it was over, so that it was, quote, moot. But it was a serious case, but it again showed me that trying to litigate in any way to hold this government accountable for restrictions, particularly on war, whether it's the congressional requirement that you have Congress approve a war, or the UN requirement that you can't go to war except in self-defense, or under Section 7 of the UN Charter. Those, when the U.S. wants to make war because it perceives that war is the way it keeps its hegemony or interest, it makes war. All the laws in the world are not going to stop it. I go back, as I think, of course, of King's speech in 67, which is still my favorite single speech, the Riverside speech, when he went beyond Vietnam, when he went beyond Vietnam and started talking about Vietnam and not just civil rights at home. And he said three things which you all know, and I like to evaluate sometimes where we are on those three things: the triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism. So it's only been 33 plus 14, 47 years since that speech. And if we look at racism, and we just put in Ferguson and the new Jim Crow, we don't have a lot of good to say in advancement on that issue. If we look at extreme materialism, just think about Occupy Wall Street and the 1%. And if we look at militarism, we probably are fighting more wars than I remember in my history of fighting wars for the last 40 years. So that's the situation we're living in. So I don't have to tell you all, we have plenty, plenty of work to do. They insisted my talk have a title. And they went back and said, title this, title that, let's appeal to people. So we titled it From Guantanamo to WikiLeaks, Taking on the State in a Post-9/11 World. Now, one thing I should say, we have not been very successful in taking on the state in the post-9/11 world. But let's talk a little bit about that title. One is Guantanamo. Guantanamo was really CCR's and my earliest case post-9/11. Just before that, we had roundups of Muslims in the city, checkerboarded around the different prisons. We had a couple of Arabic speakers in the office so we could represent them, but we could never actually find where they were. We ultimately brought a case called Turkmen, in which we are still arguing about parts of it, but which we prevailed, in which Muslims were just picked up arbitrarily between certain ages in certain countries, but without any guilt of anything at all. I'm actually talking loudly, but I'll try harder. Okay. I should move. No, they should move. I'll try louder even than I'm speaking. In any case, the Guantanamo cases were the first real set of cases. And at the time we took them, we didn't know people would go to Guantanamo, but we knew that the president had issued an order saying he could pick up any person anywhere in the world and take them to an offshore prison, and they would have no trial and no right to test their detention. You probably all know that story. At that time, it was late 2001. The first people went to Guantanamo in January 2002. The center started by representing some of the first people at Guantanamo. We could get no other human rights organization in the country to do it. They were afraid of losing their funding. They were afraid the anger in the country was too great, and no one else would join us. A couple of other lawyers, death penalty lawyers, did join us. On that, I guess, you know, death penalty lawyers are used to that kind of anger in a community. So we began with Guantanamo, and despite the efforts of all of the lawyers we eventually put together, some 600 lawyers, as David said, we haven't yet closed Guantanamo. And in my view, I'm talking about Guantanamo in the title because it's emblematic, really. It's emblematic of the barbarism that this country has sunk into. What I call at Guantanamo forever detention, drones, which are assassinations, torture, which we did on a rampant scale, war, which we're doing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, we'll count them, war crimes, massive surveillance. We're in a very, I don't want to be Pollyannish here, we're in a very dark time. So that's that part of the title. The other part is WikiLeaks, and that gives me more hope, not necessarily in a grassroots level, which is where I think change comes from, but in the sense that it's really opened up this government. And when I speak about WikiLeaks, I'm not just talking about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. I'm talking about Chelsea Manning, who gave out hundreds of thousands of pages of the Iraq war logs, the Afghan war logs, the collateral murder video, the 150,000 pages of Cablegate. I'm talking about Chelsea Manning. I'm talking about Jeremy Hammond, who hacked into a private security company. And I'm talking about Edward Snowden, who is in Moscow. Those are people who, in the face of this, what I would call barbarism, actually made choices that could literally, in some cases, did put them into jail and still may put them into jails for a long time. So those are the kind of people and the heroes that we need to take on the state, the Chelsea Mannings, the Ed Snowdens, and the like. And when I thought about it, I had a discussion recently, I was just saying to David, I recently met with a group which probably most of you don't know. It's called the MST. It's the Movement for the Landless Peasants in Brazil. And it's huge. It's 2.5 million landless peasants who over the years have fought to get their land back and have an incredibly organized system. They have activist schools. They're probably one of the major progressive social forces in the world right now. Very active in Brazil. And I spent a lot of time talking to them. How do you work? How do your schools work? How are the wage differentials work? you know, there's lawyers in the group, there's 400 lawyers in the group, et cetera. How does all of this work? After we had that long discussion, they started asking me all about WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, Ed Snowden, and the rest. And they spent an hour with me knowing where are they, what are they doing, why are they doing this. And it seemed peculiar and odd to me. I said, they're organizing this huge landless peasants movement, and why do they care about these cases that have exposed both wide government surveillance as well as criminality by the U.S. government? And, you know, I've always been, and a lot of people have supported WikiLeaks, Chelsea Manning, the whole exposure, on the basis of we shouldn't be surveilled, we should have privacy, government criminality should be exposed, and this is all a good thing. And what MST said to me, one of the leaders of MST said to me, without missing a beat, he said, the reason we support Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, Ed Snowden, WikiLeaks, is because what they did is a blow against imperialism. So I just, to hear that from the global South saying what is going on for them is that this is a way of beginning to tear apart the fabric of hegemony of the United States. And if I have to admit to myself why I have taken so much effort and the center so much effort around defending WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, and the others, is because we don't see it as just a question of beating back surveillance. Of course you have to do that, or of just exposing criminality. But we see it as some way of beginning to throw some kind of a wrench into this hegemonic system that, in my view, is still what King said, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. So that explains probably better than anything my own involvement. Now, we can talk a little bit about the third part of this sentence, talk. It says, taking on the state in a post-9/11 world. As I said, at first I didn't want to make that talk because it's not exactly a talk of my great or the center's great successes. In the past we won before 9/11. We always had trouble, obviously, winning on national security issues. We won on issues with great hard fights, as you know, even post 9/11, on issues of race, particularly in this city, a stop and frisk, as well as the fire department discrimination case. Those took 14 years. They didn't finally get settled until we had a new mayor. The other mayor fought us tooth and nail on what should be bread and butter non-discrimination cases, complete bread and butter. But on the other bigger cases, taking on national security, we have not had a lot of success. What we looked at 9/11, we looked at, tried to use law as a means of enforcing restraints on force. That's what I mentioned to you with wars, both the Constitution and the UN Charter, as a means of guaranteeing the integrity of human beings so they couldn't get tortured, they couldn't get indefinitely detained, and as a means of holding the government officials who did those things accountable. And I have to say, in those respects, the law has been a colossal failure. And not just a failure, but post 9/11 has really eviscerated the lip service that have been paid to legal restraints in this country for many years. The limits on the use of force to settle disputes, in other words, war, rendition, torture, and on, they really don't exist anymore. In a way, it's not a nice story to tell, but I try and think, what can I learn out of this story? What can we all learn? First lesson, and I'll give a couple examples as I go on. First lesson is how relatively easily the United States can cast aside legal constraints when power in this country thinks that war and casting aside those constraints is necessary to continue in power. The bombing of Syria is the latest example. No UN authority, no congressional authority. Second, something we all learn in high school, Sounds great. Checks and balances. Oh, my. We're going to have Congress check the executive. We'll have the executive check Congress. We'll have the court check them both. And they'll keep checking each other back and forth. Well, what you realize as you go on in this work, and post 9/11 in particular, is that those three branches of our government all grow from the same tree of U.S. power. And there's a time when that checking doesn't work at all. There's little play in it sometimes, but essentially on national security issues, whether it's war or Guantanamo or torture, those three branches worked hand in hand to ensure that those crimes would occur and that there would be no accountability for them. That's the second lesson. Third, that these laws and these restraints are for others and not for the United States. The U.S. condemns what it calls aggression in other countries, but the U.S. is never the aggressor. It condemns Russia as an aggressor in the Ukraine, but its invasion of Iraq in 2003 is somehow not an aggression. It refers Gaddafi to the International Criminal Court, an international criminal court that the U.S. has refused to join. There are, of course, many, many such examples. I'm going to talk about two of the litigations and then close the talk on hopefully a slightly better note. Perhaps the most telling litigation is the one that I've already mentioned, which is Guantanamo, or what we call the forever detention regime. Today, 149 people remain in Guantanamo. Almost none of them were ever charged or tried. 79 have been cleared by our own government. That means they should be free to leave. Even the government said they shouldn't be there anymore. Many have been there 12 years or more, had little children who are now 15, 16, 17, 18. Think of those human beings, held incommunicado first, tortured, and now tortured in another way by being force-fed. You know, I sometimes think when we all did the work around Chile and Pinochet, imagine if Pinochet ran such an island off the coast of Chile where he put his political prisoners, and it had been going on 12 years. Well, perhaps the government here wouldn't be screaming, but a lot of us certainly would. And of course, there was a lot of screaming about it when Obama took office, and he promised to close it in 1 year. It appears, though, that now that the Democrats are in office, that closing is far, far away. Yet Guantanamo is what I call one of our successes. In a way, it was, but it was limited. Initially, when we began the case, there was no right to test your detention, what we lawyers call the right of habeas corpus. After years of litigation, we won two cases in the Supreme Court that created a habeas corpus right. You could go to court and test your detention. That created the lawyers' movement, 600 lawyers, and many of them still at it. We did get a number of Guantanamo people released, not through litigation. Almost no one ever got released through litigation, but by various pressures, countries saying they wanted their citizens back, that kind of thing. But today, the right to habeas corpus, the right to test your detention, is a right in name only. No one is being released by the courts, and the courts are actually stymieing the right to be released. It's a right, as I said, in name only. We have legitimacy on the surface. Yes, we can go to court, but that's all. We have no remedy. And all three branches are involved. Obama says he keeps trying to close it. He has the right to close it, doesn't. Congress says you don't have the right to close it, but there's exceptions, and you can close it through those exceptions. And the court refuses to hear any other cases. Three branches, three sets of clay feet. And if I look at what happened to what I considered fundamental norms of our civilization, I go back to what's coming next year. People may know. It's the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta, 1215. That's what set forth the proposition that no person shall be sent to prison without a trial of his or her peers. That Magna Carta, the foundation of our Constitution, is essentially a nullity for the people at Guantanamo, for the people at Bagram. Those legal protections have been utterly eviscerated. We fight, of course, because we must. We fight because those inside do not give up hope, but we will need more than the law to end Guantanamo and what it stands for. Two other examples I'll go into briefly. Torture. Post 9/11, this country openly and notoriously practiced torture. They used utterly spurious arguments to justify it. We discovered it slowly at Guantanamo, at Bagram. We made huge efforts to stop it and hold the torturers accountable. We tried to get those who approved it, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, those who set the intellectual framework, you, Bybee, those who carried it out. No lawsuit got anywhere, not here, not in Europe. We still have one pending in Spain. Am I hopeful? I'm always hopeful, but it's been many years. No criminal case. Obama gave a pass to all the torturers. Despite the absolute prohibition in the torture convention, despite our law's prohibition, no one has been held accountable. Yes, Obama, as far as we know, stopped torture. Not completely. There's something they call Annex M in the Army Field Manual that still allows sleep deprivation, solitary, and sensory deprivation. Those taken together can amount to torture. But without accountability, real accountability, torture becomes simply a political game. It becomes, does it work, does it not work? Should we use it next time, should we not work? Should we not use it next time? It becomes essentially a political football. And so in that sense, this country will torture again when it believes it is threatened, and other countries as well. The U.S. has given a license to countries all over the world to torture. I've talked a bit about war. I'm going to say one more word about war. I've been trying to stop war since the first day I left law school, and probably since way before then. The first case, when I went to the Senate, there was a case against the Vietnam War. It's by Liz Holtzman. By 81, 76 to 81, we had what I call, some people call Carter a weak president. I loved him because he never got us into a war. That's only partly so. And it was after Vietnam. Vietnam was over in 76, so he had all these laws. The War Powers Resolution stopped the CIA from spying, all this stuff. And then, to my great shock, Reagan took office in 81. And then we began 10 years of some of the worst wars this country has engaged in, which were the Central American Wars. And those are what an area I worked on tirelessly, bringing a first case called Crockett v. Reagan in 81 on behalf of Congressman Crockett. First test of the War Powers Resolution, and we came close. The judge, because it was so close to Vietnam and the War Powers Resolution had been passed, and the U.S. had put 500, quote, advisors into El Salvador, she didn't give us a victory, but she came close. I forgot her name of the judge, but it was a federal judge in Washington. We went on to litigate every war after that. Nicaragua, Salvador, Grenada, Iraq won. We lost them all, and of course, the farther we got from Vietnam, the worse the decisions we got from the courts. When the 2003 war came along, an illegal war, certainly from the UN point of view, not from our Congress because they voted for it, by that time I'd given up. I wasn't going to litigate another war case. Yeah, there's some value in litigating and losing, but I think we'd had it. We just tried as hard as we could to enforce the war powers. Now, what's incredible about that war, and of course, you I sure will agree with me, the one vote I can never forget, of course, is Hillary's vote. Hillary voted for that 2003 war. And if we look at the 2003 war and we look at ISIS today, there's a direct connection between that war and what's going on right now in the Middle East. I'm not the only one that's saying that. Patrick Coburn is saying that. Wise commentators all over the world are saying that. Not only did it increase the tension between Shiites and Sunnis, it destroyed Iraq as a country. We then destroyed Afghanistan as a country. And we led, really led to the place we are today. And it's also important to remember 2003, that war was what we call a war of aggression. That's the war we tried the Nazis for in Germany. That's the greatest single international crime you can commit. It's considered to embody every other crime, murder, burning, destruction, etc. And you can't ever really forgive Hillary for voting for that. And you really can't forgive her because I think she actually didn't believe it. I think she did it for expediency because she thought that would give her the presidency. Obama perhaps felt otherwise. She made a mistake, but it's one thing to believe a war you support. It's another thing to let a million people be killed out of expediency. She was not the only one. We know the liberals who went behind it, if you want to call them that. Tom Friedman, George Packer, Anne-Marie Slaughter, New York Times. Liberals were at the heart of support of what has to be the worst single decision this country has made since 9/11. I don't know how many of you knew of Tony Jute. Tony Jute wrote a great piece on this, English writer. He's dead now. And he called these people and others Bush's useful idiots. And that's the appropriate slogan for every one of them. I recently came back from London, and I'll tell you about that as I end. But on the plane, I read an article by Hans Blix. You remember him. He was the weapons inspector who found no weapons of mass destruction. And here's what he said in the article. He's 86, living in Sweden, I guess. He said recently, he blames the Mideast upheaval on the invasion of Iraq. And he says, quote, U.S. created anarchy. The invasion was illegal. It was in violation of the U.N. Charter. I could go on and talk about our wars, Afghanistan, et cetera. But of course, there's the AUMF, which is authorization to use military force, which those of you who are my age will remember the Gulf of Tonkin, which allowed this widespread ability of the president to go to war whenever he wanted. That's the authority the president had to go into Afghanistan. That's what he's using, arguably, to go into Libya, completely unjustified war, Yemen, Syria, Iraq again. I read a count by another friend who said we're in seven wars now, seven that we know about, probably a half a dozen that we don't. My conclusion from all this about war is that basically this is a country of war. We talk of legal restraints by Congress and pundits, and that's just talk. They're all put aside when war is perceived by some to be in the national interest. My last topic on this, I'll go briefly, is the one that gives a little bit of hope, which is what we call the area of surveillance, secrecy, privacy, truth tellers. That's what I began with. WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, Jeremy Hammond, Edward Snowden. There we've had some success, not in a legal sense, but because of heroes coming forward. As a result, we know a lot more about what used to be the pervasive surveillance state, and we know a lot more about the criminality of our government. Even prior to those revelations, many of us had concluded that our privacy was over. I remember Julian Assange wrote a book called Cypherpunks, in which he pointed out that one $30 million computer, country of Colombia, had the ability to take in every single communication coming in and out of Colombia, every email, every phone call, every Twitter. So he said, essentially, it's over. His answer was, which seems very hard for even me to do, who has friends who know how to do it, is to encrypt everything. Well, that, you know, I'm not close to that. But there's no, so on that issue, we thought that before the revelations. What we had and what we still do with a combination of surveillance and secrecy is secret government and public lives. Of course, it should be the reverse. We should have public government and private or secret lives. The litigation so far, really nothing to show for it. The legislation we all hoped for in light of Snowden, little or nothing to show for it. What is encouraging to me is that publishers and journalists and whistleblowers, truth tellers, keep making choices to risk all, and more surely will. I was at a conference when Julian was speaking on a screen out in Colorado. It was before Ed Snowden's name had come out publicly. We knew about some of his work. We didn't know it was Ed Snowden. Julian gets on the screen and he says, I can guarantee you that the person who did this is going to be under 30 years old. The NSA now has to hire tens of thousands of people for its systems. A lot of those people don't agree with the NSA. A lot of them are libertarian, they're leftists, they're progressive. They don't agree with the government. 2 hours later, comes out Edward Snowden is the leaker from the NSA. How old is he? He's 29 years old at the time. I could go on this issue after issue, human rights outrage after human rights outrage, and the failure to bring this country to task. Drones, illegally supplying weapons to Israel that are used offensively, renditions, and on and on. It's not a pretty picture. Our legal efforts to restrain this government have failed. We are, as Chomsky wrote, in very dark times. I don't know how many of you read a recent short, very dark piece by Chomsky. It's titled, Owl of Minerva's View, ISIS and Our Times. If you want to be depressed, read that piece. It gets a little better later. I know you're honoring him in a few weeks, so you can ask him. But his thesis in that piece is that our civilization may be, as he says, at its inglorious end. He's very pessimistic. He describes the consequences of the illegal 2003 Iraq War and the destruction of that area, the area that civilization 11,000 years ago arose in between the Tigris and the Euphrates, which that war led to ISIS. If anybody ever asks you, where did ISIS come from? Those are the answers. After Chomsky gives you that uplifting talk about the world coming to its inglorious end, he talks about climate change. And then it all ends. And that's the way the piece ends. So I look at the piece, and my issue, and of course, it's, you never want to really argue with Chomsky, and I don't think I'm arguing with him. But the piece gave no hope for change, no recognition that we can fight back. Can we win? I don't know if we can win. But we can fight, we can make choices. Really no choice but to be engaged. And so in the Chomsky piece, there's no mention of what was going to be the next week climate march of some 400,000 people, of the massive demonstrations around Ferguson, the growing BDS movement, and the protests of the Gaza war, Occupy Wall Street, the fight on closing prisons and to end the new Jim Crow, the fight of low-wage workers, and the organization CIW, where my son works in Florida, our anti-austerity movements all over the world, or MST, the Brazilian workers movement, which I mentioned, or another group I work with called NUMSA, which are the metal worker miners, 350,000 of them, who are taking on the neoliberal state in South Africa, or people in struggle everywhere. I tell you this really to give you a sense that there's a lot more struggle and perhaps hope than Chomsky put into that piece. Yes, it's dark times, but it'll only get darker unless you act. And there are, as I just indicated, people acting everywhere. We do have choices. Then a couple of days ago, maybe a day ago, I pick up another Chomsky piece, maybe in response to some criticism of that earlier piece. This was a bit more encouraging. He was asked by the person questioning him, if there really was no hope, if the situation was that dire. And this time, he gave us words we can live by. Quote, we cannot know for sure if there is really no hope. What we do know, however, is that if we succumb to despair, we will help ensure that the worst will happen. And if we grasp the hopes that exist and work to make the best use of them, there might be a better world. And he ends, not much of a choice. And that's the way I'll end with you, with Chomsky's words, not much of a choice. Thank you.